Hey everyone, my name is Justin Cottle, and this is the Dissection Room podcast. Today's episode is going to be somewhat different than the rest of the episodes in this series on how AI is revolutionizing healthcare. And it's born out of comments I've seen on other YouTube videos, my own YouTube videos, as well as just comments and conversations with many different healthcare workers over the years. And it goes something like this: AI has been threatening my job for decades, and it never goes anywhere. The AI that is implemented into healthcare is really not that great. And at best, it's an annoyance, and at worst, it can be dangerous. And trust me, I get the sentiment. I really do, because if you look at where AI has been implemented into medical devices and different workflows, it hasn't been that impressive in a lot of areas. At the same time, though, there's obviously different kinds of AI, and AI is absolutely everywhere. So there's a large amount of places that it has benefited inside of healthcare. But I understand the overall sentiment. But here's the thing. When I have conversations with healthcare workers, it's made apparent to me pretty quickly that they just simply don't understand how it's different this time. And I know that sounds like a fanboy. I know that sounds like I'm feeding into the hype, but I want you to just stay with me for a second. Things really are different this time. And that's my goal in today's episode, is we're going to take a step back. In previous episodes in this series, we've been focusing on how AI is going to affect DOs, MDs, radiologists, and their mid-levels. And those are really practical and grounded approaches. What I want to do is take a slight step back and just kind of see how AI has developed over the years and started to implement itself into healthcare and what makes it different this time. Now, obviously, this podcast is not a computer science podcast, so this is not going to be so overly technical that it's just going to go right over your head. Instead, my goal and my hope is that I can make the technical aspects understandable, but I truly believe them to be important, because if you don't understand some of this technical jargon, just the evolution of what's been happening, it's easy to kind of push this off, to be a little flippant with it and just say, oh, been there, seen that, done that, when that is the wrong approach to take. Look, if you're even somewhat paying attention to the AI space today, you're aware of the threat of job loss that people are starting to fill. You're seeing this with art, you're seeing this with graphic design, but you're seeing it with things like CPAs, you're seeing this with paralegals and lawyers. But what I have, or the sense I've gotten, is that most healthcare workers right now feel immune because they are relying on bedside manner. They're relying on the difficulty and the problem set of navigating patient care. And again, that is completely understandable, especially if you're viewing this from the lens of how it's been historically. But what I want to do is try and reframe this for you, because if your expectation is that a robot is going to be coming into the hospital room, is going to be dealing with the patient, administering medications, interacting with them, being their doctor, if that is your expectation, then yeah, that's not going to happen in the next few years. That is going to happen at some point, but maybe that's 20, 30 years down the road. It's hard to say. Instead, I want you to try and reframe this a little differently. Instead of thinking about outright job loss, I want you to think about, how is AI going to change your job description? And when you start thinking about all the things that wouldn't require a robot, so we're talking your workflow, the paperwork, little tasks here and there at all levels of healthcare. Because here's the thing, there's so many different positions inside of healthcare. It's hard to generalize and say, it's going to affect it this way or this way, or that way. It's hard because there's so many different jobs and duties. But if you can think, how could AI affect my job, the paperwork aspect or certain aspects of my workflow, what kind of ripple effects will that have on the rest of my job description? These are the questions we really need to start asking, because at some point, that's going to start to, you know, you're going to look at the institutions and they're going to start looking at how much they're paying employees. You know, if your job description gets cut in half, or even a quarter, let's say a quarter of it goes away, is that worth reducing pay? I don't think so. But at the same time, what happens when it gets to be a half? What if it's three quarters? if all you're doing is the physical labor aspect, are you just doing more and more and more of that? These are the questions we really need to be asking. So instead of thinking, is AI going to replace me? I want you to know it is going to replace you, but that time horizon is likely farther in the future for multiple reasons. For me, I am only able to look at things for about 5 years out. And that is due to just the nature of how this is all evolving. It is basically impossible to really see beyond a time horizon of 5 years in the AI and technology space right now. It's just that difficult. And so the question I'm always asking myself is, what is this going to look like in 5 years? And we're going to see there's significant hurdles. And there may be hurdles that we're just not aware of. That's how these things work. Where, you know, you think things are just going to keep on progressing and then boom, you run into a wall and you have no idea what to do. And we're going to discuss how that's happened in the past. That is always possible. But I want you to understand that if all of a sudden the United States government and the world governments and everybody just put a moratorium on AI development and we just stopped every bit of advancement right here, right now, you still have to understand that it's going to change everything. Everything that has already been developed, all the training, everything that's already happened is already going to change things. And then we're just waiting for the FDA to approve and clear these things, start putting them, implementing them into networks. So this is the kind of framework and lens you got to start viewing the world from. And so my goal is not to be fear-mongering. I'm not out here to be like, it's coming for your job. I want you to live in fear. It's more to just try and bring awareness of how the healthcare worker life is going to change just like it's affecting everyone else. AI is coming for us all. Does that mean replacement? When I say coming for, it sounds ominous. Sounds like it's running after you and it's going to tackle you. I'm not saying that as much as I'm saying it's going to impact you. For some jobs, I do see it being an outright replacement in 5 years. In other jobs, I don't see that happening. Instead, it's more of a collaborator. But we still need to be thinking along those terms. So this podcast is going to be kind of like, this episode is going to be looking at like the history of AI to some extent, but we're really going to be trying to focus on that relevant history for healthcare and why and how the advancements made are going to impact us today. So this is going to get somewhat technical at times. My hope is that it's not overly technical to the point where you just tune out. But I truly believe this to be important because if you don't understand what's happened and how it's changed, it's easy to just be flippant with this. And so we are going to get a little technical, but I want you to know, if you're watching this on YouTube, you can always just look down in the progress bar, see the chapters, scan through, find the information that's most useful to you. If you're listening on Substack, Apple, Spotify, you can look in the show notes. And what you'll find is timestamps that'll let you know, hey, I want to go here, I want to go there. So don't feel like you have to listen to the whole thing from beginning to end, although it'll definitely make more sense if you do. Now, I've been paying pretty close attention to this space for the past 2 years, but I've been interested in this whole realm for the better part of a decade. And that's really just biotechnology as a whole. We're talking, you know, from the ground up. So proteomics, genomics, molecular and cellular biology, all the way up to like robotic assisted surgery and other medical devices. This entire area is so fascinating to me. And especially having worked with many medical device companies over the years, it's just really cool stuff. But at the same time, there are significant hurdles that these technology companies have to go through in order to implement this technology. So I spoke about this at greater length in the previous episode. So if you want to know more about this, I encourage you to check that out. But I do want to talk briefly about just FDA clearance versus FDA approval. And this is one reason why my time horizon is still at 5 years, because to get technology and new devices approved, or even if you're just building upon previous tech, it takes time. So, you know, FDA clearance is more about lower risk to patients. That may take 6 months to a year to get something approved in that sense. But if you're going for full-on FDA approval, this is class three. This is where it's a higher risk to patients. That can take a year or more depending on what it is. Now, with that said, let's kind of jump into this. And I want you to understand that machine learning is nothing really new inside of medical imaging and diagnostics. But to best understand its use cases and its utility, as well as its limitations, we also need to understand some of the history of machine learning. Now, machine learning at its core has what's called neural networks. And neural networks, or at least the groundwork for neural networks, goes all the way back to the 1940s and 50s, except at this time it was pretty much all theoretical. We just didn't have the technology to really play around with it in any meaningful sense. It wasn't until the 60s and 70s that, you know, some excitement started to build in the AI space, but they ran into one of those barriers, one of those walls that we mentioned earlier, and it all just kind of came to a grinding halt. AI researchers started to like leave and go do other things such as like physics and other aspects of computer science, helping to build out PCs and everything that went with it. And AI just kind of fell into oblivion, more or less. And it wasn't until the late 80s when a man by the name of Yann LeCun, who is the current chief AI scientist for Meta, who owns Facebook, reinvigorated the whole field, where he developed a new machine learning method for image recognition, which is going to be important to us, called a convolutional neural network. Now, a neural network is loosely modeled after the human brain, or at least the structure and function of the human brain. And so if you think about it, like there are neurons, and then neurons have dendrites and have axons, and the dendrites and the axons connect at what are called synapses. That's kind of what they're building out with neural networks, or at least machine learning neural networks, with artificial neurons, right? You have interconnections and different layers, and that's exactly what a neural network is. And in fact, in a future episode, I plan on doing a more in-depth breakdown and comparison between human neural networks and machine neural networks. But for now, as long as you understand that neural networks were developed to try and imitate and mimic how the human brain works to some extent. Again, this is a loose modeling. You understand enough about neural networks. So between the late 80s and the 2000s, there wasn't a ton of advancement. The AI research was still progressing, and I don't want to make it seem as though no advancement occurred. It's more just like there wasn't a ton of excitement. AI was still kind of like this redheaded stepchild inside of computer science. You didn't have the top people going into AI by any stretch. It was not really seen to be the place to go for like an MIT graduate, for example. But in the early 2000s, and just the overall 2000s, something else came to fruition called deep learning. You've probably heard of deep learning. All it is a neural network, like we discussed, with artificial neurons and synapses and everything, but it has multiple layers to it. And the thing is, that's actually modeled after the cerebral cortex. The cerebral cortex, or the gray matter of your brain, also has multiple layers with all those 86 billion neurons residing inside of it. So, but what these layers are going to do is you could almost think of them like a filter, right? Or a series of filters. So let's put it like this. Let's say you put in an image, because remember, a convolutional neural network is really good at image recognition. So let's say you want a deep learning network to be able to identify who's in an image, right? So I give them a picture of Justin, and it's like, here's a face. Tell me who this is. Well, what happens is the first layer of those artificial neurons kind of just like find the edges of the picture. It finds like certain like lines and just edges, and that's it. And then what it does is it takes those edges and that information and gives it to the next layer, which will then put them together to create shapes. So it can maybe identify like the eyes or the nose. And then that information will go to the next layer. And it keeps doing this handoff of to each layer until you get to the very last layer that puts it all together and is able to then recognize that, that is a picture of Justin. So that is kind of like the basic way you can think of a convolutional deep neural network working. And that's what makes it so good at image recognition, is it takes it step by step by step by step until you get an output that you want. So then we move into the 2010s and deep learning took off. We're talking just took off, because I want you to think for a moment, what else changed for your average person in the 2010s? So 2010 through 2019. Social media just exploded. Now, you have to understand AI is everywhere. And what we're really talking about with that is deep learning networks. And these can be implemented in many, many different ways, not just convolutional neural networks. There are so many different types of AI, deep learning networks, and other types of just models and algorithms. The reason I'm focusing on convolutional neural networks or CNNs is because they're hyper-relevant to what we're going to be discussing with medical imaging. But I don't want you to think that's the only type of neural network, because it's not. But in the 2010s, everything exploded because people started playing around with this. They were able to inject large amounts of data into it, and it completely reshaped society as we know it. You're starting to see this not even just in social media. You're seeing, say, this with like the streamers like Netflix and Disney Plus and all of these. That AI, deep learning, allowed for some really cool stuff to happen. But in 2017, another change happened in AI. And this was a paper produced by the Google research team called Attention is All You Need. And I briefly discussed this in another episode. I'm going to still just briefly touch on it here. But what it did is it made people aware of the fact that you could actually give a lot of text to an AI, and instead of reading every single word sequentially, like you're reading a book, you could pay attention to certain parts of the text, and then that would provide enough context for you to understand everything within the entire text. And so this is a self-attention mechanism. But what we call these are transformer models, and allows you to transform things. And there's more to this, by the way. But transformer models basically come in two types. Again, this is technical. Don't worry too much about this, but you have like BERT or a GPT. There's actually more, but those are the two big ones. Just understand that transformer models allow you to, well, allowed us to make advancements in what's known as natural language processing. This is huge. Natural language processing is kind of like the holy grail when it comes to coding and processing. So if you think about coding, like all the people at their computers going to boot camps, data coding boot camps, there's all these different languages. There's C++, there's Python, there's so many different programming languages, but you have to learn it. You have to sometimes even create it and build it. And this takes a lot of skill. Even if you learn the language, to be able to speak it efficiently and effectively and build something really meaningful and cool is really challenging. You know, great coders, great programmers, like they are very good at what they do. It's not just because they know something and they're following steps. They're very creative in how to use that language. But the holy grail, the ideal situation has always been that you could just like get on a keyboard and say, I want you to build me a website. It'll be red, it'll be this. And you, through natural language, be able to then have an output like that, right? You're coding. The programming language is natural language. That has always been the hope. And in 2017, with this attention mechanism, we've figured that out, right? Obviously, we needed years to really build it out, but the underlying mechanics and understanding of how to do it was then understood. So what transformer models do is you can put in a prompt like text, and it can transform it into an image. It can transform it through the coding language to a video, to sound, right? You can have these varying outputs. And this is huge. This is what has fueled the AI revolution that we're currently in with ChatGPT and Google Gemini and Claude and, you know, Midjourney, and everything you're seeing right now is a direct result of this paper, Attention is All You Need, out of Google Research. All of that came in 2017. So the question is, when did AI start to become meaningfully implemented into healthcare? Because it wasn't back in the 40s and 50s. It wasn't even the 60s and 70s, or really even the 80s and 90s. Now, I don't want to make it seem as though there were no applications or AI-based health applications in development, or, you know, that were being given to physicians to experiment with, because there were. It's just they weren't impressive. And that's not to say from a lack of trying, it's just that there were significant hurdles that AI research and development had to overcome, not just in healthcare, but overall. You have to understand the limitations on AI were going to be things like there wasn't much data to go around. at all. You had computing and processing power, electricity, and again, you needed AI researchers to not be, you know, focusing on building out just Google search or building not even in the 90s, there was no Google, but I mean, you have to understand, like, this wasn't the exciting area of development that it is today. Well, all of that changed in the 2000s. And you have to ask yourself, well, why? Why did everything change in the 2000s? Well, it's the internet. So the internet being developed in the 80s and then really starting to catch, you know, wind in the 90s, but everyone was on the internet in the 2000s. And what that also means is that healthcare records and medical data was now being digitalized or digitized. So we originally had all these x-rays, CTs, all this kind of medical data that was existing in boxes in storage centers was now being put into a digital format. And what that meant is you now had a ton of available data. And if you remember, this is also when neural networks started to be developed. And so now what you're starting to see is excitement. You're starting to see people wondering, what can we do with this? Can we train these neural networks to be able to recognize and diagnose? And so this is the beginnings of that. But even then, that didn't take off until the 2010s. If you remember me saying, the 2010s is where deep learning just really, really took off. And so this is when we started seeing different medical device companies and startups starting to implement AI applications into healthcare. This is where we started meaningfully training medical images like CT, MRI, X-ray, ultrasound, starting to try and help radiologists. And not just radiologists, but anyone in the world of medicine that uses medical imaging. So dermatologists, cardiologists, even neurologists when it comes to data analysis. And so, but if you were to ask any of them, right, if you were to ask a radiologist, you know, back in 2012, who's playing around with some of this, like, is this coming to replace you? No, not at all, because it was still problematic. It still had a ton of issues. This was a newer technology, and there were still, and there still is a lot of kinks to get out. But at the same time, a radiologist does a whole lot more than just diagnosing. And the same goes for all of these different aspects of medicine. But at the same time, so I don't want you to think like, just because these applications were being developed, it didn't change everything overnight. And this is where I think a lot of people who are still inside of healthcare, are their mindset is still back then. Because this is even the case all the way up until around 2018-ish, 2019-ish. They're still in this mode of like, well, the AI that I've interacted with is not very impressive. And I understand that sentiment, but things are definitely changing. Just understand it didn't change everything, but at the same time, it was very useful in certain use cases. So look at ophthalmology, for an example. In ophthalmology, there's a type of photograph called a retinal fundus photograph, where you take a picture of the back of the eye, and you can see the neurovasculature, and you can just start determining certain aspects of the overall eye health. AI, so you have these convolutional neural networks that are really good at image recognition, were trained on many different retinal photographs, and were able to determine things like diabetic retinopathy. For dermatology, we did the same thing with skin lesions and skin cancers, and that started to help and aid and improve the dermatologist's diagnostic ability. Did it revolutionize things? No, I don't think it's fair to even say that. And then you have to, again, ask yourself, well, what else does an ophthalmologist and a dermatologist do? What else do all of these physicians do? This is why there's never really been a meaningful threat to these healthcare providers, because there's so much more to the job that they do. But then everything also changed again. And this is where we're at right now. And that is with the advent of transformer technology. So again, that BERT and that GPT. So when that attention all is all you need paper came out, all of a sudden people started to play around with more potential around transformer models in medical imaging. Now, I discussed this at length in a previous episode, and what we're really talking about here is synthetic data. Now, synthetic data is not fake data. I know that sounds like it is, but if you want a really deep understanding of synthetic data, you want to go to the previous episode on this, and I'll go ahead and link that above for those who are watching on YouTube. But synthetic data is not actually unique to transformer models, you could build synthetic data with convolutional neural networks as well. But here's the thing you have to understand. Not every medical image has the same resolution. Some of them have really poor resolution. There's certain, say, like an fMRI or certain types of CT, different types of like a mammogram will have higher resolution. So if you're looking at different medical images, some of them have such high resolution that our technologies just wasn't good enough to create synthetic data. But with the advent and creation of transformer models, we now have what are called like vision transformers that have really good resolution that can start filling in the gaps where we didn't have them before. Understanding synthetic data, not being fake data, this is what you're doing is you are training a model on real data to produce, again, like not real data of medical images and say like adhesions that are really difficult to come by. So for instance, you could, with through a prompt, say, I want to create a bunch of x-rays, chest x-rays for a certain kind of carcinoma that's going to be in the lung. And you can find these edge cases and you can actually create it. And then you can train other neural networks on that to better identify them. The point here is transformer models started to be able to increase the resolution. And so now we could match the resolution at low resolution all the way up to high resolution. And we're still seeing the implications of this. I don't want to make it seem like this is just like widespread within healthcare and training these different models. But again, it's 2024. And if we're asking ourselves, what is things going to look like by 2029 or just the end of the decade? These types of synthetic data sets are going to have really impacted these different models and training them to identify and do different things. So that was absolutely and still is absolutely huge. But beyond that, in the 2010s, we started to see robotic-assisted surgeries. I mean, this is where you're starting to see, you know, giant robots that are guided by the surgeon to be able to perform very precise surgery. This is very, very cool. All of that is fueled by AI. You have to understand, like, if you have this really fidgety robot arm with a scalpel and hemostat and everything, you're going to cause real damage. To be able to do microsurgery, you have to have AI that is going to be able to help and benefit this. So that took off in the 2010s and is only improving. And then we also have drug discovery. And this is something I am going to be doing an entire episode on because this is groundbreaking. This is huge. This is the kind of stuff that, you know, this is hype right now, but if we follow this to its natural conclusion, this is the beginnings of getting rid of disease, of getting rid of aging and things of that nature. We're nowhere close to that, but it's still very exciting when you look at what AI can do with material science and drug design and drug discovery, looking at how proteins are folding. When you put all of that together, you can advance pathophysiology and our understanding of pathophysiology and pharmacokinetics to such a degree that it just starts to, there's breakthroughs happening in pharmacology right now, and there has been, and it's only going to continue to increase. Now let's take a quick step back into those transformers that we mentioned earlier. So this is like your BERT, your GPT, your vision transformer. This was huge and still continues to be huge. And this is what really shakes me to my core when I start thinking about the implications of this added with convolutional neural networks and other AI that has already been trained and continues to improve. And that just comes back again to the natural language processing of large language models. So ChatGPT obviously revolutionized everything. And now we see other ones like Claude and Gemini. And I talked about this in a previous episode, so I encourage you to go back and watch that one around physicians and their mid-levels being possibly replaced. But I talk about specific large language models in development from Google called MedLM or MedPalm2, MedLM, and then AMI. So instead of ChatGPT and Gemini and Claude, who are trained on pretty much the entire corpus of information on the internet, instead, you're training these large language models on medical data specifically, or medical questions and medical text. So like the preponderance of published literature that is in existence, as well as medical licensing exam questions, And then these are all overseen by physicians. But these LLMs are trained on actual bedside manner. They're trained on physician consultations. And so what you're getting is, and these are starting to score higher on empathy. Now, look, here's the thing. Whenever I see this online, people talking about the empathy of these large language models, I don't really buy it yet. It doesn't seem anywhere like I don't feel real empathy coming from these large language models as I'm interacting with them. But apparently they are scoring high on empathy scores, but nowhere near like what a healthcare provider or worker would be able to give. The point I'm trying to make, though, is it's improving. And you have to understand that this is beyond 5 years, but it's something I do want to briefly mention, is that what's happening right now is a lot of medical device companies are building their applications and their products on the backbones of these large language models. So what that means is you have ChatGPT, which is really GPT-4, and if you take GPT-4 and basically plug it into some of these new medical devices and these different applications, it what fuels it and runs it. It's how you interact with that device. So then what happens is every time ChatGPT gets updated, so when GPT-4 becomes GPT-5, these medical devices also get updated. And that is going to continue to happen. Now, there is problems with this, right? The FDA doesn't allow you to just update everything and anything however you want. There's criteria for how you update things. So again, this is one of those hurdles that we have to understand. But at the same time, you just understand that these medical devices are going to improve, even as things that aren't technically for medical or healthcare providers, such as ChatGPT, as those improve, even the healthcare realm is going to improve. But these are also starting to fuel robots. This is where it gets beyond the 5 years. It's hard to put a number on this because it's really just speculation. When is a robot going to be able to come around and see patients and all over the place, right? To go to their rooms, to take their vitals, to administer medications, to change their sheets. When you're talking about all the things that you will see like a nurse or an MA do, or when you start seeing that, it's like, okay, when is that realistically going to happen? It's hard for me to see that happening in any time frame under 15 years, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's 20 or more. So we're not talking about that necessarily, but there's other medical devices. I want you to think about this. This is kind of interesting. For those watching, you'll be able to see this. This book is called The AI Revolution in Medicine, and it's from Peter Lee. This is a really great introduction to AI in medicine. It's crazy. It's already starting to become outdated, just the nature of the world these days. But what I think is fascinating that a lot of people don't really understand when it comes to the power of large language models is something that Peter Lee outlines in the very first chapter. And what he does is he gives a scenario of, I'm not going to say the exact scenario, but picture this. Let's say that an EMT or a paramedic or a nurse even working actually out that is working in a hospital or a clinical setting is running into a problem that they don't know how to solve. Even if a physician is doing this and they just grab their phone, and in the book, he's saying GPT-4. I would not ask ChatGPT this, but let's just kind of roll with this. When we go back to what Google's developing, right, these large language models that are specific for the healthcare world, and you say, and you sit there and list off all the patient symptoms and signs, what you're seeing, and then you're able to even upload or even discuss some of the patient history. This is where you're getting again into more speculation, but at the same time, it seems very reasonable. All of a sudden, ChatGPT, in his example, gives very specific instructions on what to do. I, again, am not saying that we want to do this with ChatGPT now, but I want you to think how this is going to develop over the next few years when you have FDA-approved large language models that are trained and fine-tuned by healthcare providers that are extraordinarily knowledgeable, not just on healthcare protocols and practices when dealing with patients, but the entire published literature. Also, this AI understands the patient's electronic healthcare records. It's their entire medical history. And what you're able to do is you have frontline workers who are able to interact with it and ask it questions on what to do in this situation, that situation. You start to see the collaborative nature of this, where all of a sudden, imagine your, I say this with respect, your lowly medical assistant could have the most accomplished physician to ask questions to at any time that will give them immediate responses and understands everything that you can possibly understand about the patient right then and there. This is something that technology currently exists. What you're looking for is FDA approval, because obviously that's going to need to be approved and not just simply cleared. When you start pairing those AIs, before I even say that, I want you to think about this, and I'm probably going to talk about this in another episode, but I want you to think about it. What I just described is an agent. An agent in the AI lingo is an autonomous program that you can give an instruction to, and then it just sees that through to the end, more or less. Now, so think about it like this. Imagine taking the power of GPT-4 and you fine tune it and you say, look, your only goal is to peruse the entirety of the medical literature and figure out what the most responsible and likely treatment protocol is given this patient's current set of symptoms. That's it. Then you have another agent who also has all this training, but has been fine-tuned for another specific task. And then you have another agent, right? You have to understand this is all code. This is all code. So if you can build one agent, you can build thousands to millions potentially. I want you to start thinking about it like this. As these large language models and more robust neural networks are starting to become agentic, that is the term, right? Agentified. If you have these agents all throughout hospital networks, they can work with each other just as you would have in any network of physicians and healthcare providers and healthcare workers, and they can all work together to find a solution, except they are extraordinarily knowledgeable. I want you to think about the power of this when you attach that to a human healthcare worker, when you attach that to a nurse, when you attach that to a paramedic, when you give all of these different agents. Now, again, that is within 5 years that I see that type of thing either starting to happen or it's been around for about a year or so. Again, there's speculation there, but at the same time, the trajectory we're currently on, that makes a lot of sense. And this is where I start to really question how this is going to affect job descriptions. When you have essentially potentially thousands of the most well-trained, knowledgeable healthcare workers doing things that don't require physical labor, and you have that, say, like on a hospital-issued cell phone, that right there is what we're talking about when we revolutionize medicine. That is absolutely incredible. And so I've thought about doing episodes on how AI is going to affect very specific types of medicine, right? Are we talking about urgent care, emergent medicine, like pediatric medicine, hospice? Like, we're talking everything. When you really start thinking about the power of this, it's hard to not get excited and just filled with awe, and then also wondering, oh my God, this is absolutely incredible. And here's the thing. Pretty much everything I just talked about is possible right now to some extent. And notice, I didn't say it replaces anyone. What that does is it just adds, it's a tool to be used inside of healthcare. Just think, how is that going to develop past 5 years? What is that going to look like in 10 to 15? I don't think people are really thinking about this very deeply because they don't understand how precise this is starting to get. When we're talking about terms like precision medicine, personalized medicine, when you start integrating this information with smart tech, there is real potential here to revolutionize preventative care. And I know this sounds hypish. I know this sounds like I'm excited, but I want you to know, if you spend an hour, if you were to take an hour out of your day and just start Googling the advancements that are being made and everything that is coming down the pipeline, you would understand exactly why I'm saying the types of things that I'm saying. This is not just rampant speculation. This is very grounded speculation based on what is currently possible. We're not talking about future tech. Now, there are limitations to this. There's all sorts of things that we have to figure out. And I discussed this in previous episodes where it comes down to are you HIPAA compliant? The whole thing around privacy of data is so important. Can you just give electronic health records to an AI? Where is the server for that AI? Who has access to this? There's all sorts of things. Liability is something that people talk about all the time. And I got to be honest with you, that one is becoming less of a concern to me. I understand the concern, but I want you to think about it. If we're able to start improving diagnostic accuracy, if we're starting to improve emergent outcomes and just other clinical outcomes with patients to such a degree that it's better than your average physician, I'm not as concerned about liability anymore, because then it becomes, statistically, I'm probably going to do better if the judgment call is being made by an artificial intelligence that has the power and knowledge of the entire, human species, more or less. Again, that is pie in the sky. That is more speculative. I'm just saying we do need to figure out liability, but it's not as big of a concern to me. There's all sorts of other things. Computing power, literally electricity. How are we going to fuel this? These are hurdles that could we run into and it may become a barrier. But even with all that said, the advancements that have been made are enough to shake healthcare to its core. So without some kind of moratorium, this is only going to improve over time. In a future episode, I actually plan on really diving deep into agents, because even just discussing it right now, it's hard to say it concisely to such a point that people can easily understand what is possible there. So, if I could even just bring you back for a moment, just understand when it comes to agents, the potential of agents, just understand it is potential at this point. We do not have the ability to just let agents run and solve tasks as much as we want. That's growing. That is happening. And who knows, something may come out next week that completely changes that statement. But as of recording this right now, what is today, March 21st, we don't have that ability. But it's really looking like that is the direction that many of these AI companies are desperately pursuing, including OpenAI, who develops ChatGPT. Because the promise that comes from agents is not just in healthcare and medicine. Imagine if you just have the ability to type in through a prompt, hey, I need you to build me a website. And it builds it to completion. I need you to, if we're talking about data analysis, you can just start thinking through all of the different areas in the workforce. There's so much potential for agents that you can just give a simple prompt and it sees the task through, and you don't have to constantly coach it. Instead, it just through programming knows where to go with it. There's a lot of potential there. But there's still a lot of work that needs to be done. That is not an easy problem to solve. But you have a lot of very talented and intelligent people working on it right now. And that's what excites me. So my goal with a future episode is to dive into what could we do with agents. I want to get more specific and grounded with it, because I think that alone will probably blow your mind. Because that's what's, I think, if I'm really saying what has just lifted the veil from my eyes these past 2 years is thinking deeply about autonomous AI agents and what they could be capable of. So my goal is going to be for you to share in that vision with me. But I hope you enjoyed today's episode. This was meant to be kind of just giving you a somewhat better understanding. And I want you to know this is still just scratching the surface. I could probably devote this entire podcast, I'm talking every single episode, to AI and how it's revolutionizing healthcare, if we just broke it down piece by piece. Not just how is it affecting pediatric medicine? How is it affecting, pediatric medicine when it comes to newborns and infants? How is it affecting K-12? How is it, this is how specific and nuanced we can get. And I don't think I'm going to be able to do all of that. There's other things I want to talk about when it comes to AI besides just in healthcare. Specifically right now, I'm really focused also on education. but I'm hopeful that this at least gave you somewhat of an understanding of how things are different. They're not the same as the way they used to be, and they're never going to be the same again. We're not going backwards, we're only going forwards. Even if we stop, we still have more forward momentum to carry us for a bit, and that is going to leave a lasting impact on every part of the workforce, but it's also going to affect healthcare. So there's not this immunity that a lot of healthcare workers think they have. I understand that sentiment, but things have changed.